I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Our guest, the novelist and teacher Doug Bauer, says, if you want to write fiction, begin, of course, by reading the masters. And then, when you encounter a passage or a scene or a description that stops you dead in your tracks, he says, you have to disassemble it, examine its parts, and see how they cue and complement one another. Doug Bauer says that the use of the article an instead of the is to the beginning, is the key to the beginning of the Grimm's fairy tale, Faithful John. And he also thinks he knows why the opening line of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude is so captivating. It goes like this. Many years later, when he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. Note, he says, the movement, the change of tense, the masterful juggling of the chronological balls. We're poised to plunder the masters this hour. Doug Bauer is here to give us our first lesson. But Connection listeners, this is one of those programs where we need your help desperately. You've got to get us started. What are your own favorite beginnings of books, endings of books, passages of dialogue, or description? Who are your favorite characters in literature? Which writer is your great teacher? Make the writing workshop Connection this hour with Doug Bauer. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. Doug Bauer, welcome. Let's all pretend we might have talent here and we can learn something and put it to use. Give us three, if you would, just three or so citations from the great masters that can teach you something.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. The way I've done this book, the stuff of fiction, is to separate it among various aspects of the craft: openings, closings, characters, events, sentimentality, etc., etc. And one of the things I looked at in terms of openings, as you referred to in your introduction, was the way that the fairy tale starts. And there's a wonderful kind of cadenced, careful, descriptive, bringing the reader in to the story that the fairy tale is sort of, you know, typical in its construction. But there's also a very contemporary way of doing that. And I particularly love, for example, the writer Marilyn Robinson's novel Housekeeping, which was a very important novel to me in the early 80s. And listen to the opening of Housekeeping, which has a very obvious literary echo, which begins like this. My name is Ruth. I grew up with my younger sister Lucille under the care of my grandmother, Mrs. Sylvia Foster, and when she died of her sisters-in-law, Mrs. Lily and Nona Foster, and when they fled of her daughter, Mrs. Sylvia Fisher. Obviously, my name is Ishmael is what we immediately think of there, and I'm sure that wasn't accidental on Marilyn Robinson's part. But what I love so much about the way that the sort of lyricism and the rhythm of that opening characterizes itself is the way it just sort of draws us in. It's just this sort of beckoning index finger saying, you know, come with me, come with me. There's always also an aspect of its fact that it's a first-person narrator. I grew up with my younger sister, Lucille. And when you use the first person, when you say I as a narrator, you're already implying that it's you and the reader having this conversation, just you and me. Let me tell you a story. It's by its nature a much more intimate voice than a third-person omniscient narrator. I mean, if this was to say, her name was Ruth, she grew up with her younger sister, you're already a little bit further distance narrator to reader in that conversation.
Tell us the name of that novel again, but then give us another example.
This is Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson.
Okay.
Let's go then from the chapter on openings to, let's say, a chapter on dialogue. And one of the things I talk about in this chapter is the idea that dialogue in novels or in stories, in fiction in general, is apparently conversation between or among its characters. But there's a third character, if you will, in this whole enterprise, which writers have to be mindful of. And that third character is the reader who is listening to the dialogue. And what happens when dialogue appears in a story or a novel is just perforce the reader drawing closer to the material on the page. It's an eavesdropping kind of phenomenon that occurs. Mm. And the writer should be very, very, you know, aware of the force of dialogue, the power of dialogue. And if you use dialogue when it really shouldn't be used, you're asking the reader to come close for no good reason. And you've wasted the chance that you have with dialogue. Here's a wonderful passage, I think, of dialogue from William Kennedy's novel Legs. And it serves both as an example of great dialogue and as an example of a great opening, because it's the opening of the novel. And it begins like this. "I really don't think he's dead," I said to my three very old friends. "You what?" said Packy Delaney, dropsical now and with only four teeth left. "He don't mean it," Flossie said, dragging on and then stubbing out another in her chain of smokes. Tipper Kelly eyed me, and I knew I was serious. "He means it all right," said Tipper, still the dap newsman, but in a 1948 double-breasted. "But, of course, he's full of what they call the old bully bull, because I was there. You know I was there, Delaney." "Don't I know it," said the pack. But what I love about that is dialogue, is that there's a sense in which he's just sort of offering the reader the chance to, as I say, eavesdrop on this conversation. This is the opening of the book, and the reader, in encountering this, feels as though, I think, he's sort of walked in on this conversation that's already begun. And it's another kind of wonderful rhetorical way of getting the reader to sort of say, you know, to scramble momentarily and say, who are these people? Where am I? Who are they talking about? It's not so distancing that the reader is alienated. The reader really wants to know, but it has that terrific kind of coded quality about it, as though these characters know, of course, what they're talking about. It's our interest as the reader to find out what they're talking about. And playing with that idea of the reader as eavesdropper.
I was just going to say, I mean, the idea that dialogue is a signal to the reader to draw close,
right,
and it's got to somehow satisfy that, is a wonderful quick summary.
Well, and it's a thing that I think new writers in particular often don't realize, that dialogue, you know, while it purports to be exclusively this conversation, as I said, among the characters, it's finally intended for the reader. And if you think about the behavior of dialogue and the behavior it results in on the reader's part, you understand, as I say, the rhetorical advantage that you have when you use dialogue.
Give us one more lesson and we'll go to phones.
Okay. I have a chapter in the book on the difference between sentiment and sentimentality. And there's a wonderful moment from the John Cheever short story called The Cure. It's not one of Cheever's better-known stories or even arguably one of his great stories, but I'll never forget when I read this story for the first time. And there's a moment in it when the protagonist in the story, who's separated from his wife and who is very, very, very sort of denying of the kind of emotional ringer that he's going through over the course of this story, putting the best face on it, saying, you know, this is how my life was going to be and I was going to be perfectly fine. And then one moment toward the end of the story, when he comes home and the phone is ringing and he simply knows it's his wife calling him, and he runs in and he sees in his living room down toward the baseboards the fingerprints of his children. And he says, and this is the line, "I had to get down on my knees in order to kiss my children's fingerprints." Mm. And what is so masterful, I think, about that line is that it's almost matter of fact. It almost says to you, in its tone, in the simplicity of the language, "Of course, I got down on my knees to kiss my children's fingerprints. You would too. I mean, that's not the point. The point is, here's how I had to do it," and the understatement, the kind of emotionless quality of the prose in the telling of the moment is what keeps it so powerfully full of sentiment without, you know, going over into sentimentality, where the prose would be just very, very high-strung and overwrought, excuse me, and would, you know, as I say, destroy the mood, destroy the effect.
The writer again.
John Cheever.
The
story
the John Cheever.
Is The Cure.
I love the thought that you first just have to notice those moments or stop when a piece of writing just sort of knocks you down, mm-hmm. and say, wait a minute, what in the world is going on here? We did a program with Saul Bellow on Ravelstein not long ago, and I don't think I thanked him for this paragraph. There's one short paragraph, five sentences, late in the book. It's Ravelstein and his pal Chick. They're just talking, gabbing, gossiping. What do you hear? Remember this. Look at that. And they're talking about a couple that they both know and love dearly, a professorial character named Battle and his wife Mary, and they've had a great love affair. And then Ravelstein says, just casually, he says, you've heard the story. After one dance with Battle, whom she had never met before, she left her husband. She stepped into Battle's arms, and that was that. In the same instant, both parties recognized that their respective marriages were ended. He was strong on the tennis court and on the dance floor, but he was no seducer, and she was not an unfaithful wife. He said he'd be waiting for her at the airport.
Mm.
Where was that again? In Brazil. And they've had a happy life. And there are a lot of long novels that don't tell you as much about
right.
two people as that.
One of the great things about that passage is the elliptical quality of it. I mean, it almost tells you as much by what it doesn't say as by what it does say. What it does say that
absolutely. I mean, literally, it's five sentences,
yeah.
and you see them in faraway Brazil. You see them on the tennis court. You see them dancing. You know what a moment that was. There's so many others. There's a Cheever description that I wanted to read. I mean, there's so many things, and lots of people will have more. But here's just here's from a Cheever story called Just One More Time, a description, introductory. She was a good-looking woman, long-faced and with that New England fairness that seems to state a tenuous racial claim to privilege. She looked imperturbable. When they were on their uppers, she worked. First at the Steuben Glass store on Fifth Avenue, and then she went to Jensen's, where she got into trouble by insisting on her right to smoke. She went from there to Bonwitz, and from Bonwitz to Bendel's. Schwartz's took her on one Christmas, and she was on the street floor glove counter at Saks the next Easter. She had a couple of children, between jobs, and she used to leave them in the care of an old Scotchwoman, an old family retainer from the good days, who seemed just as unable as the Beers to make an advantageous adjustment to change.
That is Cheever country par excellence. I mean, it took me a while to love Cheever, and now I think I love him more than any writer of contemporary or recently deceased.
The good ones are awfully good. We're talking about what you can learn from master storytellers if you want to write, and to take note of those passages that say, holy mackerel, that's something. Doug Bauer, whose new book is called The Stuff of Fiction, is our teacher. Give him a call at 1-800-423-TALK. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other NPR stations. Contributors also include Beacon Fiduciary Advisors, private money managers coordinating all the financial facets of life.
Doug Bauer, he's teaching us this hour. In the book, you cite a wonderful little story about Harry Cruse, the Southern novelist. In his own recollection of his falling in love with Graham Greene's novel, The End of the Affair, a passion that reached such a pitch that he literally took his copy of the book apart, tore out its pages and spread them on the floor, and used to walk around among them so as to understand the structure of the novel. That's a sort of parable of what we're doing this hour, talking about favorite passages and what you can learn from them if you're trying to learn how to write. 1-800-423-8255. Makes the connection. Richard is on the line.
Yes, I'd love to hear you broaden it perhaps beyond even the English language, although it would be in translation, include Camus. And the first line of The Stranger, which is something like this, Mother died yesterday, or was it the day before?
Yeah, absolutely. Aujourd'hui,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. that's for me just sort of. I mean, that was a blow to the gut. You know, I mean, it was such a powerful beginning in terms of setting everything that was going to happen from then on.
What's wonderful about that in its assumption is that I love the idea that he didn't say my mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that already you're assumedly in a relationship with this narrator.
Yeah.
The implication is, you know who I'm talking about, my mother.
Right.
I don't need to introduce you to my mother. So there's that wonderful kind of opening contract, as the Israeli writer Amos Oz calls openings with the reader. And then yesterday, or was it the day before? That tells you volumes about the narrator.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Good, thanks. Richard,
thank you. 1-800-423-8255. I should just say a lot of people have written in favorite passages to the Connection Forum on the website, and you can still do it at theconnection.org. We're talking about instructive, great passages from stories and novels that can teach you something about the creation of fiction. 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Allie is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Allie.
I love your show.
Thank you.
And I just have also, I've devoted many of my past months to starting a reading journal in which I write down opening lines or any lines from any of the fiction I'm writing that just knock me out.
Mm, good.
It's a step beyond keeping a journal. It's just specifically a reading.
Commonplace book, okay.
Yeah, and I'm devoting my time also to reading the great writers, and I'm just finished reading. I'm a big fan of Robert Louis Stevenson, who was a Victorian storyteller par excellence. And I love the way he opens Dr. Jekyll, the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, with a description of not the main character, which is Jekyll and Hyde, but the person through whose eyes we will hear the story, which is the lawyer, Utterson.
Vladimir Nabokov loved this story and thought it was a masterpiece. Give us a taste of it.
Yeah.
Allie.
Very from the start. Mr. Utterson, the lawyer, was a man of rugged countenance that was never lighted by a smile, cold, scanty, and embarrassed in discourse, backward in sentiment, lean, long, dusty, dreary, and yet somehow lovable. And he goes on for actually a fairly lengthy paragraph to describe this man, right down to his habit of drinking gin when he was alone to mortify a taste for vintages, and how he enjoyed the theater but had not crossed the door of one for 20 years, you instantly fall in love with this irascible curmudgeon who will be the witness to the horrendous pages that follow.
Is Allie learning the right things, Doug?
Well, she's certainly casting the right eye on what she's reading. I say in the introduction to the book that It's a kind of both a gift and a curse that when you are a writer or and trying to be a better writer, you really read in a very different way than when you were a child, with that kind of innocent avidity of just falling heedless and headlong into the tale. I mean, you read as a writer much more pragmatically, and you're really saying not so much, you know, how did he or she, the writer, how did they do that? But in fact, you're saying, how did they do that? So you want to know.
Can you sort of lay bare the model and then build it up back up your way?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think it's an essential step to becoming a better writer to steal. And then, you know, you steal from many sources, and the hybrid of all that which you've stolen becomes the writer that you are.
Allie, I want to just throw back at you something from Stevenson's friend Henry James as a description. It's out of the same general box. Early on in The Wings of the Dove, of Merton Densher, the main man character in it, but it's this beautifully, you'd say, imitable series of contrast. It's a very structured one hand, the other hand, and it goes like this at the beginning of the book second of Wings of the Dove, talking about Merton Densher. He was a longish, leanish, fairish young Englishman, not unamenable on certain sides to classification. But he is in certain ways an unresolved figure. It goes like this. He was young for the House of Commons. He was loose for the army. He was refined, as might have been said, for the city. And quite apart from the cut of his cloth, skeptical, it might have been felt, for the church. On the other hand, he was credulous for diplomacy, or perhaps even for science, while he was perhaps at the same time too much in his mere senses for poetry, and yet too little in them for art. You would have got fairly near him by making out in his eyes the potential recognition of ideas, but you would have quite fallen away again on the question of the ideas themselves. The difficulty with Densher was that he looked vague without looking weak, idle without looking empty. It was the accident, possibly, of his long legs, which were apt to stretch themselves, of his straight hair and his well-shaped head, never the latter, neatly smooth, and apt into the bargain, at the time of quite other calls upon it, to throw itself suddenly back and supported behind by his uplifted arms and interlocked hands, place him for unconscionable periods in communion with the ceiling, the treetops, the sky. He was, in short, visibly absent-minded, irregularly clever, liable to drop what was near and to take up what was far. He was more a prompt critic than a prompt follower of custom. He suggested, above all, however, that wondrous state of youth in which the elements, the metals, more or less precious, are so in fusion and fermentation that the question of the final stamp, the pressure that fixes the value, must wait for comparative coolness. And it was a mark of his interesting mixture that if he was irritable, it was by a law of considerable subtlety, a law that, in intercourse with him, it might be of profit, though not easy, to master. One of the effects of it was that he had for you surprises of tolerance as well as of temper.
One of the great things about the master is that he's incapable of writing a simple character. Even his most minor characters are full of complexity. And in the book, I argue that every character, no matter how simple, no matter how flat in E.M. Forster's distinction between round characters and flat characters, even the flattest of characters need to be complex. And what James does there is that is in that wonderful sense of contradictoriness that every aspect of the character that he describes to you is a sort of this. On the other hand, there's that. It's always the sort of surprise within the assumed context that he's offering you there with this character. You may think that because he likes this, he's this way, but in fact, he's that way, even though he likes this. And that kind of wonderful kind of, you know, back and forthness of surprise that defines complexity in character, I think.
We're talking about the passages that knock you out and that can teach you something at 1-800-423-8255. Brandon is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Brandon.
How are you?
Good.
I have a question for Mr. Bauer. I'm very interested in, it's funny that he was talking about simplicity versus complexity, because two examples of sparsity really come to mind. One was a recent book by Howard Norman, The Bird Artist.
Yes.
And I know the opening line of that book is, I believe it reads, "So my name is Fabian Voss, and I live in Whitless Bay, and I'm a bird artist. But I also killed Botho August, the lighthouse keeper, and that is an equal part of how I feel about myself."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a great
and
opening.
It's a fascinating line that sort of draws you into the story right from the first page. And I was interested in your feelings on sparse writers. I know another example, Kafka's Metamorphosis.
Right.
His opening line is extremely sparse. You know, Gregor Samsa woke one morning to find himself transformed into a large dung beetle.
One day upon awakening from agitated dreams.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. So I was interested in your opinions on flair versus sparsity, as being a 26-year-old aspiring writer myself.
Well, I think if you're talking about, when you talk about sparseness, if you're talking about style, sort of a more florid as opposed to a more spare style, I think it has everything to do. First of all, you have to write the way that finally you feel is the way you can best express yourself fictionally. But I think there's almost a kind of it's almost like a rule of physics that the more emotionally charged the moment or the scene in what you're describing, the more pared down the language should be in order to convey that charge. Because if you try to have a sort of a faux power in the language to match the moment, The language is getting in the way of the event you're trying to describe. And you'll find it, I think, almost without exception, that the really great moments of action, moments of emotion, moments of drama, even in a writer like Faulkner, he quiets the language in order to let the event come through. And what those two openings you just mentioned of Kafka and Howard Norman. What makes them, I think, so successful is the almost casual tone of the way they offer this quite extraordinary information. In the one sense, in the one case that the fellow is a murderer, and the second that the fellow is a beetle. And if you were to say, "Listen, let me tell you this. You sit down, wait. I've got this extraordinary confession to make." That's counterproductive to the kind of wonderful ease and therefore that sort of delayed moment of surprise that comes when that information is given to the reader.
Do students actually pick this stuff up, and is their last paper different from the first?
Sure. The students are interesting in that it seems that a lot of serious students now. Want to write, but they haven't read much, and that's always a kind of odd combination of experience to me.
What's the teaching moment, though, in your own experience, when a student gets it? What turns them?
Sometimes it's careful reading. Sometimes it's just a matter of saying, "Look," as we've sort of just been doing here. As Harry Cruz did, taking the book figuratively apart and walking around among its pages, and you say to the student. You have to start reading much, much more with a sense of, how did he do it, rather than and to really just pay quite kind of mercenary attention to what's
read
going
like
on.
A burglar. 1-800-423-8255. Irene is on the line.
Hi. Maybe that last point is it covers what I'm trying to do. But one time I heard somebody's name, an unusual name, and I said, I know who this person is. I mean, I have a whole story written around this person. It started out as kind of a bodice buster, kind of a parody, and then he turned into something really serious and of historical fiction in the Revolutionary War and the Triangular Trade. And, everybody who hears me go through this plot says, oh, what happens next? Hmm. It's a yarn, not great literature. But how do you get this on paper? I write wonderful, wonderful, factual, very clear accounts. I was an English major years ago, and I can write something very clearly and factually. But I can't get my hero from one side of the room to the other, and where do you start?
Listen carefully, Irene.
Well, you said you wrote factually, and maybe there's something in that. I mean, maybe what you need to do is really find a way to sever that umbilicus that's holding you to the fact. If you're basing it on something that is factual, I mean, it's not until you're really floating freely in an imaginative sort of sense of inspiration that true fictional surprise can occur. And I think, in the spirit of what we're talking about here today, if you can isolate those writers who for you answer that question just so beautifully, what happens next, what happens next, what happens next, and if you can be just absolutely clinical, just almost microscopically clinical about how they achieve that, then you're a long way toward recognizing how it's done. The rest, as I say in my introduction to the book, alas, is a matter of talent. And this is no guarantee that, all the kind of good at reading and good advice and good instruction in the world will produce literature.
1-800-423-8255. Just get a lot of blank paper, Irene, and start writing. 1-800-423-8255. Robert is on the line.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Welcome, Robert.
Wonderful topic.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm a total word junkie and have made my living writing in the various forms from advertising to stand-up. I now travel the country with a 25-character play where I play all the characters and have my first novel coming out in the fall schedule of a major publisher next year. And I wanted to talk about sort of going on what the guest had said before about angry moments being covered better sparsely. When I was taking a cross-country railroad trip to a gig, one of my friends gave me a Larry McMurtry book, and I was sure that I was above Larry McMurtry and didn't have anything to offer me, even though this was around 1991 and he had already won the Pulitzer. And from one of his lesser-known books, Some Can Whistle, I opened up the first page of the book on the train, and the entire first chapter blew me away, but the first two sentences sucked me in like none of the quote classics are...
Robert, you better just read it, man.
Okay, it's from Some Can Whistle. "Mr. Deck, are you my stinking daddy?" a youthful female furious voice said into the phone. I could not have been more startled if I had looked up into the blue Texas sky and seen a nuclear bomb on its way down.
Don't discount wherever you might find the great models. What I think works so well in that I don't know the book, and what seems to me to be working so beautifully there is, again, it's one of those openings where he's giving you a little bit, but he's not giving you too much. He's asking, you know, the reader to say, in effect, scrambling to kind of find his place in all of this. And there's enough of an authority. There's a wonderful kind of great narrative authority there that tells you, the reader, well, the writer knows where he is, and he's going to tell me where I am. And it's that sense in which, you know, the story or the novel is a room filled with characters, and the opening is that door that opens up into the room, and the narrator has various ways of opening the door. Sometimes you just throw the reader in without warning. Sometimes you stop him at the door before you let him in and say, here's what you're about to find on the other side. There's all kinds of subtlety and variation in the degree of preparation you give the reader before you let him into the room.
Let's take a short break and ask people to call in more of their own favorite passages. Nabokov, Dostoevsky, Howard Rourke in The Fountainhead. We'll be back. This is The Connection.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other NPR stations. Contributors also include NetNumina, partnering with financial companies to transform business challenges.
Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Ledden. This is the Stuff of Fiction connection with the writer and teacher Doug Bauer. He says when a passage in fiction knocks you out, stop, mark it, take it apart, look at it, imagine how you'd imitate it. One of the things that we haven't talked about, and we haven't talked about sort of devices, tricks, one of them is lists, which often catch my eye. Here's one from a wonderful John Updike story in the New Yorker maybe a year and a half ago. It's in his new collection called Licks of Love, in which a man is recalling his first marriage, 1950s or 60s, and he's recalling the way they drank. Don could remember the drinks on porches and docks, on boats and lawns, in living rooms and kitchens and dens. The high metallic sheen of gin, the slightly more viscid transparency of vodka, the grain golden huskiness of bourbon, the paler caustic timber of scotch, the sprig of mint, the slice of orange, the chunk of lime, the column of beer with its rising flutes of bubbles, the hemispheres of white and red wine floating above the table on their invisible stems, the little sticky-rimmed glasses of anisette and cointreau and B&B and green chartreuse that followed dinner, whirling the minutes toward midnight, while the more prudent, outsiderish guests peeked at their watches, thinking of the babysitter and tomorrow's sickly sweet headache.
The way lists can work, of course, is if they aren't merely lists. And what's so beautiful about that in Updike is that list tells you everything about, first of all, you can imagine the guy licking his lips as he's thinking about those drinks. I mean, just the great passionate love he has for booze, that's conveyed by the lavish attention and the description and sensory sense, the sensory attention to each of those kinds of liquor. And it tells you, you know, the culture. It tells you a point in time, a place. I mean, and that's the real work that something like a list has to do. If
it's, the words are beautiful, too. And yeah. Also, there's a passage of time, really, from, you know, first cocktail mm-hmm. on the deck to the sticky sweet after-dinner drinks and people looking at midnight.
Exactly.
To get home.
Yeah.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Doug Bauer and the stuff of fiction and what you'll learn from the great storytellers about your own writing. Susan is on the line. Hello, Susan. Try it again. 1-800-423-8255. Jerry is on the line.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling, Jerry.
My favorite passage is a writer, Joan Didion, and it's on Keeping a Notebook. And I like it because it describes, it does a beautiful job describing like the dark side or the demons that of self-examination. And I'll read just, it's just a paragraph.
Go for it.
I think we are all well advised to keep on nodding terms with the people we used to be, whether we find them attractive company or not. Otherwise, they turn up unannounced and surprise us, come hammering on the mind's door at 4 a.m. of a bad night and demand to know who deserted them, who betrayed them, who is going to make amends.
Didion at her neurasthenic best there. Yeah.
You know, a listener has sent in onto the website a beautiful passage from Salman Rushdie. I'm not even sure what the book is, but it's so wonderful. He writes, I was born in the city of Bombay once upon a time. No, that won't do. There's no getting away from the date. I was born in Dr. Narlikar's nursing home on August 15th, 1947. And the time? The time matters too. Well then, at night. No, it's important to be more on the stroke of midnight, as a matter of fact. Clock hands, joined palms in respectful greeting as I came. Oh, spell it out, spell it out. At the precise instant of India's arrival at independence, I tumbled forth into the world. There were gasps, and outside the window, fireworks and crowds. A few seconds later, my father broke his big toe, but his accident was a mere trifle when set beside what had befallen me in that benighted moment, because thanks to the occult tyrannies of those blandly saluting clocks, I had been mysteriously handcuffed to history, my destinies indissolubly chained to those of my country. Must be Midnight's Children.
Yes, I was going to say, it's the opening of Midnight's Children, yeah, yeah, as would be suggested by the content of it. You know, one of the things that that opening does, too, is if you know the book, I mean, it's just such a an extraordinarily magical, almost surrealistic account, and he's already taking you out of reality there with the way he's describing things and what he's describing, and he's saying in effect time is subject to interpretation. We're not sure, you know, even where we are and where the ground is here. So that sets the sort of terms of the narrative as well.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone. Mark is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Mark.
Chris.
Yes.
Hi. I'd like to close perhaps with a passage from Herman Melville's closing of the story, Bartleby. Do you know the story?
Of course.
Right. So Bartleby was...
I'd rather not, or whatever he says. What is it?
Right. I prefer not to.
Right.
Bartleby was the human Xerox machine who died in jail of a kind of depressed refusal to everything. And Melville says he had a report of what Bartleby had done before he became a copyist. He says the report was this: that Bartleby had been a subordinate clerk in the dead letter office at Washington. When I think over this rumor, hardly can I express the emotions which seize me. Dead letters, does it not sound like dead men? Conceive a man by nature and misfortune prone to a pallid hopelessness. Can any business seem more fitted to it, to heighten it, than that of continually handling these dead letters and assorting them for the flames? For by the cartload they are annually burned. Sometimes from out of the folded paper the pale clerk takes a ring. The finger it was meant for perhaps molders in the grave. A banknote sent in swiftest charity. He whom it would relieve nor eats nor hungers any more. Pardon for those who died despairing. Hope for those who died unhoping. Good tidings for those who died stifled by unrelieved calamities. On errands of life, these letters speed to death. Ah, Bartleby. Mm. Ah, humanity.
Mark, your voice is made for the part, too.
Thank you. Enjoy your show, Chris.
Mark, thank you. Doug Bauer.
Yeah, that reminds me of listening to that ending, that, you know, wonderful T.S. Eliot says something about the frontiers of consciousness where words fail but meaning still exists. And I think that's in some ways just the perfect way to think about an ending, where there's a kind of aftershock, a kind of lingering resonance to an ending that, you know, then the words are done on the page, but if the words and the momentum leading up to that ending has done its job, then there's a resonance that continues after the words have ended.
Doug Bauer, give us one more sort of very concrete lesson out of the book, about maybe the one about sort of high moments, mm-hmm. climactic events.
There's a chapter in the book called High Events, and where I talk about the essential difference between dramatic moments in you know, just plainly commercial fiction versus more serious literary fiction. And it seems to me, from teaching for a lot of years, new writers have this sense that if they're going to be, quote, serious, they can't really talk about anything dramatic, because that's sort of, you know, working in the gutter. And their stories are so sort of devoid of event that they just don't have any life in them. And my advice to them is that if you know how to render event, anything is game, you know, the most extreme moments. And what I say finally in the chapter that for me kind of makes the distinction between serious and schlock is that somehow, remember, as I say, that schlock is primarily interested in the breathless depiction of the drama, while literary fiction is interested in the richness of the resonance. And because that resonance is the true condition of the world, it should also be true of the worlds we make in fiction. Our lives, if we let them, can advise us on our art. So I'm really saying that in addition to studying the great masters on the page, look around us too, and try to take the true temperature of, you know, the condition mm-hmm. that we're inhabiting at the moment.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Stuff of Fiction connection. Bill is calling from Jay, New York.
Hello, Chris. Thank
Welcome,
you for
Bill.
The search for knowledge. I appreciate it. My passage that really grabs me is the opening page from Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, the chapter that she calls Heaven and Earth in Jest, in which with an amazing, simple, symbolic rendering, she opens up the entire question of good, evil, life, death, mystery, and just about every question you could possibly want in life.
Read it for us,
I'd
Bill.
I'd love to. Let me just slip it right here. Heaven and Earth in Jest. I used to have a cat, an old Fighting Tom, who would jump through the open window by my bed in the middle of the night and land on my chest. I'd half awaken. He'd stick his skull under my nose and purr, stinking of urine and blood. Some nights he kneaded my bare chest with his front paws, powerfully arching his back as if sharpening his claws or pummeling a mother for milk. And some mornings I'd wake in daylight to find my body covered with paw prints and blood. I looked as though I'd been painted with roses. It was hot, so hot the mirror felt warm. I washed before the mirror in a daze. My twisted summer sleep still hung about me like sea kelp. What blood was this, and what roses? It could have been the rose of union, the blood of murder, or the rose of beauty bare, and the blood of some unspeakable sacrifice or birth. The sign on my body could have been an emblem or a stain, the keys to the kingdom, or the mark of Cain. I never knew as I washed, and the blood streaked, faded, and finally disappeared, whether I had been purified myself or ruined the blood sign of the Passover. We wake, if we ever wake at all, to mystery, rumors of death, beauty, violence. Seem like we're just set down here, a woman said to me recently, and don't nobody know why.
I'm glad you brought Dillard as an example, because it, a lot of what I'm talking about in terms of fiction is equally applicable to serious literary nonfiction. You know, the same notion of what makes narrative live. And in that beautiful opening of Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, you've got so many of the senses activated. It reminds me of Flannery O'Connor's great advice, you know, who said in one of her essays that if you don't have at least three of the senses moving simultaneously in your description, You don't have your passage really moving with the sufficient life that it should have. Mm. So there's a whole idea of, you know, stroking those senses, getting those senses activated, which the Dillard passage makes a great example of.
Bill, thank you. Thank you for your reading, too. Paul is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call. Thank you. I don't have a particular passage, but I just want to get a plug in for my favorite short story writer, William Trevor.
Mm-hmm.
And in his recent The Hill Bachelors.
The Hill Bachelors, yeah.
Yeah, there's a wonderful story of the cloth, which in less than 20 pages, he says more about contemporary Ireland and what's happening there in terms of the position of the Catholic and Protestant churches and their role in Ireland than you could read in several doctoral theses, I'm sure. There's a wonderful description of a conversation between an old Protestant minister who has long since lost his influence in Ireland because of the rise of the Catholic Church and its power, and a Catholic priest whose position in society in the last 10 to 15 years has substantially decreased. And they have a conversation in the dark. It seemed to Grattan that it was possible to say that in the dark, when it hadn't been before, that truth could flourish in the dark, that in the dark communication was easier. These two men could speak to each other much easier in the dark than in the light because they were supposedly old foes, but they weren't really. And just a plug for a short story writer who can say so much in 20-odd pages than, like, you know.
Paul, you said it beautifully. I'm going to seek out William Trevor again. Thank you. Thank you, Doug Bauer. Doug Bauer's book is called The Stuff of Fiction, Advice on Craft. Connection listeners, thank you for all that people have sent onto the Connection Forum already. You can continue the Learning How to Write conversation on our website. Send more favorites to theconnection.org. Thanks for help today from Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Sarah Field, Dan First, Hitesh Hatti, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, Keith Shields, and Will Smith. Mary McGrath is the master of our classroom. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.